Bewildering. That's the only way to describe my behavior after a trip to Ho-Chunk Casino in the spring of 2005. Brought me a quick $1,100 win. Before I realized what was happening, I had gone from having no interest in casinos and gambling to thinking about nothing else. In fact, the few times I had been in casinos before April 30th, 2005, I found them nauseating. Too much smoke, too much noise, too many gaudy lights, and too many people engaging in what I thought was a really stupid activity. Putting money into machines and watching the reels spin round and round. And the people seemed to have the same strained look on their faces, as if their lives depended on the outcome of those spinning reels. So when my friend Bev called that day and invited me to go to Ho-Chunk with her, I told her what I usually told people who asked me to go gambling with them. Nope, I don't like casinos. I even went to Monte Carlo, and that's supposed to be the most famous casino in the world, and didn't like it, so I'm not about to go to that place. This time all I got out was, no, I don't like casinos, before I heard myself saying, you know what, yeah, come and pick me up. Let's go.
That's from the opening chapter of Sandra Adell's new book, Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Why would a successful UW professor and accomplished actress find herself drawn over and over again into the seedy, smoky world of casinos? What is the relationship between her troubled childhood in Detroit and her descent into gambling addiction in adulthood? What does the casino industry do to lure people in, rob them of their money, yet keep them coming back? Joining us to discuss her very personal memoir, Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen, is UW professor of Afro-American Studies, Sandra Adell.
Welcome back to University of the Air. It's a little different topic we're undertaking with you this time, but it's one that has to be fascinating for a lot of people, either because they say, oh, I'll never go there, or they're saying, I've been there and I know what she went through. Did you have any inkling before that first fateful trip to the Ho-Chunk Casino that you had some kind of an addictive inclination to gambling or anything else?
Absolutely not. I just went because I was unhappy. I was trying to get over a breakup that happened about 9 months earlier, and it was a pretty day, and it was just feeling very bad. And so when my friend called and said, let's go, I thought, well, I don't like casinos, but I like driving up Highway 12, and I wasn't driving. I was going for the ride and the good company and so forth, and I really didn't even want to go inside. I had been inside casinos before because I've done commercials to promote casinos. I don't do those anymore. But it just wasn't what I wanted to do. It just didn't feel good because it's garish, it's dark, it's so artificial. And I was leaving a very pretty day. I was walking outside of a very beautiful day to go into this place. But I had no idea that, you know, that this was going to send me on a nearly devastating downward spiral into gambling addiction. I had never heard of gambling addictions
before. Did you have any kind of plan for what you would do once you went in there? I mean, you were
No.
carrying a certain amount of money with you, and you said, I'm going to bet only so much, or I'm going to play this machine and not play cards, or
I
what?
Had no idea. I knew I didn't want to play cards because I don't like sitting playing cards, period, just in friendly card games. I did enough of that when we were in Detroit back in the day. And that was entertainment. I mean, just friends sitting around playing cards. But I didn't even know what to do. I just, when my friend, when we got to the casino, I just said, okay, tell me what to do. And she said, go to that machine and sit there and push the button, put some money in. Oh, she had also told me how much money to bring. You know, it was like $300. And I'm thinking, I'm on a budget. $300 is too much money, but I'll take $200. And I'm going to lose my months. I had allotted myself just about $200 a month for, you know, spending money. I'm going to lose it all in one day. I'm going to give this all up in one day. So what else, other kinds of adjustments do I have to make? Because I just was not in a good mood that day. So I didn't know what to do. And my friend was saying, okay, we got to, oh, first of all, we walked around. She said, let's walk around and find some good machines. And my thing is like, what difference does it make? The machines are going to, you know, do what they always do, which is take our money. And then she told me how to push the button, you know, which button, because, you know, you've got a lot of things moving around on the machines and they're bleeping and everything. So she said, you know, sit here at this chili pepper machine and just push the button. And she said, alternate between a dollar and a quarter or something like that. And it was like, oh, boy,
And you're just literally pushing a button.
I'm literally
just sitting there pushing the button.
Excuse the ignorance, but when you're pushing the button, what is it that happens? You're waiting for money to fall out somehow?
No, you're waiting. When you push the button, it's like the armed bandit. And most of these still have, the older ones still have the, you know, the arm on the side because some people like to pull them. But the machines are always turning. There is something called a random number generator chip inside the slot machine. So they're always churning out these numbers. But what you see on the screen is the illusion that you're just about to win. So there's a button on there that says, you know, play one credit or play three credit. They never say play one quarter or $3 or whatever, you know. So that's part of the lure.
Yeah.
It's credits. So when you push the button, the symbols are going to stop in certain orders. And there's something called the near miss. And that's where those symbols stop, like just above or just below the pay line, and they're just about ready to line up for the jackpot. And that's what begins to create the tension. It's almost there. Let me push again. You know, but literally, you're doing mindless activity. It's literally mindless activity, just pushing a button and hoping that it's going to end up on the pay line so that you can get the money. But I didn't care. I mean, it was just like, I'll sit here and I'll push this button like she told me to do. I don't like it here. I don't want to stay. Now, can we go? But we had driven all the way up, you know, and she wasn't even ready to go. My friend wasn't. So she saw a man get up from another machine, and she said, Sandy, go over there and sit at that machine and push those buttons and, you know, push that button, hit the 25-cent thing. And I did, and all of a sudden this noise started, and I think it was two chili peppers and one other thing that landed on the pay line. And so then there's this escalating sound, because this was what's called a progressive machine. There was this escalating sound. And people started coming to watch to see where it was going to land. It landed, I think it was $1,100. I came out with $1,180. I remember that part. But when it stopped, then you push the button and you get this receipt. You know, it doesn't look like money. The sense of working with, playing with real money is taken away from you. It's removed by the notion of credits and on the tables it's chips. But these receipts, that sound stayed in my head for a very, very long time.
Of the payoff.
The payoff sound. I didn't realize at the time, it took me a long time to realize that this was already beginning to unscramble something in my brain. The casinos are designed, by design, they're set up to make you want to keep coming back.
In what way besides things like the sound and not letting you really think about the money? What else?
The lights, the ceiling, the carpeting, it's all very busy. People don't notice that. And I found this out when I went to Detroit to the Motor City Casino, and they had been talking about how they were expanding. This is a big casino. How they were expanding it and all the different designs they were and colors that they were using. And they talked about how overhead they had put all these flashing lights. And then the carpeting was a wavy kind of carpeting that was reflecting some of the same movement of the lights. And then even the designs on the walls were all intended to just attack all of your senses.
And do you think if you hadn't won at that point with beginner's luck or something, that it would have been, let's say you went and you lost your 200.
Oh, I think that would have been the end of it.
So winning was sort of the beginning.
It's called the early win. The people who specialize in gambling addictions call it, I mean, it's simply the early win.
Well, you know, that's got to be a really broad principle that applies not just to gambling, but you know, think of it if you were out on the golf green on the first day and you shoot a birdie or something, you're going to come back.
Yeah.
You know, whenever you can win easily, even if you know that it might be a bit of a fluke, you think, oh, there's some potential there.
Yeah.
And you've got to come back.
Yeah, but the difference is that with golf is a game and you can improve your game, right? You're playing a game. You can learn it. There's some skill involved in it.
And you're outside.
You're outside. That's a nice part. That's a really nice part. But gambling is not, except with the poker. Now, poker, I'm not a poker player, but what little bit of poker I've watched, you do have to pay attention to what's going on around you.
Even blackjack.
And blackjack, to some extent, you have to, I mean, you have to pay attention to the fact that there are other people around you. You have a dealer in front of you. Not with the slot machines. With the slot machines, it's just you and the machine, and they're awfully mesmerizing. Today, the International Gaming Technology is the organization that makes most of the slot machines in the world, and they're becoming increasingly interactive So you're not just sitting watching reels go round and round. And the International Gaming Technology, by the way, hires some of the best and most creative video game designers in the world. And the point of it is to create more interactive, faster, more mesmerizing slot machines, or video slots, as they're called today, because the younger generation grows up. I mean, you look at children. You've got little bitty children walking around with electronic devices in their hands. I'm going to tell you something that one of the things that concerns me very deeply is that, and I'm going to switch gears from the slot machines for a second, and that is simply that we hear all the time politicians and people, progressives and other folks who are concerned about what's happening in our world today, especially with the global economic situation, complaining bitterly about Wall Street, about payday loans, about the credit card company, about the mortgage industry, subprime mortgages, all of these as being predatory. But I'm just not hearing anywhere people challenging what's happening with the expansion of casinos across this country. And that's one of the things that I hope to at least start a discussion about.
Well, it's kind of a tricky political issue, isn't it? Because aren't many, if not most, of the casinos owned by American Indian tribes who have gotten the short end of the stick for hundreds of years and now finally have a guaranteed way to make money, for better or worse?
Yeah, it is a tricky situation. It's a tricky question and issue, except that if you look at the people who are brokering the land that has to be put into trust in order for the casinos to be built off the reservations, those are white men, and they're wealthy white men, billionaires. So you've got middlemen, and they're men. Mainly. As far as I know, there's only one woman who owns a casino, and that's Marion Illich in Detroit at the Motor City Casino. She's a billionaire. So these are the people who are reaping the greatest benefit of the casino industry. Granted, it's brought some economic development to the Native American communities, but it's doing great devastation, too.
Do you have a sense of what a casino does for the community where it's built? I mean, it seems to me the argument is usually made on behalf of building a casino, that it will create jobs, it will stimulate the economy. Does it work that way, do you think?
No. Let me just say that I did try to find out what the Ho-Chunk Nation does with the money it earns, gets from the casino industry. And they do have good health care programs for senior citizens. I found this out through reading some newspapers that I found at the Historical Society, language programs and so forth. But, I mean, one has to ask a question. How many Native Americans actually want to work in a casino? If you go to Ho-Chunk, you'll see that most of the people who are working there are white. These are low-wage earning people, most of them. Now, in terms of economic development, there are a number of economists who aren't being bought off by the casino industry, who are independent, who've done studies to show that it's a negative economic situation here, that casinos do not bring economic development into communities. Now, we're not talking about resorts. You know, at least we can say that Ho-Chunk is in a resort area. But what about the three big casinos in Detroit? I mean, this is my hometown. And when I go to Detroit, it just hurts my heart to see the devastation there. There are three enormous casinos, each within 2.5 miles of each other, in the downtown area, and you can't buy a loaf of bread in town. There's something insidious about this.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book, too, about the people who go to casinos and how, for the most part, they're poor. They're often elderly. You know, the people who are there at those slot machines day after day are often people who are desperate.
In many instances, certainly as the casinos are placed into inner cities, think about Pottawatomie, for example. That's in Milwaukee. You know, it's a bus ride away. And when I was on a Milwaukee radio station about 3 weeks ago, it was a call-in station, and the people who were calling in all had stories. Either they were addicted to the machines or to gambling, or they knew somebody. One man called and said he was a security guard there. He had worked for a security guard for about 6 months, and he couldn't take it after a while. He said in the first of the month, he said, see who's in there. Now, with regard to senior citizens, and I will be speaking in this community to senior citizens groups, the casinos market, you know, I used to do some of this marketing. The casinos market very heavily to senior citizens because they want to keep the casinos filled in the daytime. And this is an outing for people who are otherwise not very ambulatory and so forth. especially in some independent living communities.
And how do you market to a senior citizen group? Let's say it's a group of elderly people who would never dream of going into a casino. It's something that they would think was wrong. How, because you said you used to do commercials and so on and are aware of the sort of the marketing campaigns. How would that campaign go?
The campaign, first of all, is with, you know, come here to where the winners are and also have a free buffet. You get free food and, you know, and the food is, these buffets are good in most of the places. They come and get, or they'll send them a coupon for $10, a $10 coupon, and say, come in and play the slots and then you might get a free meal. That's the way they encourage folks. But also, and here's the concern, is some of these centers organize tours to the casinos as one of the activities for senior citizens. And I'm going to speak to a senior citizens group in Middleton in June. And I think I have to be careful about how I speak to them, because for some of them it's an outing. But I think what I want to say is be aware of other people in your group on your bus. Because the truth is that the senior citizens are losing money like crazy. They don't have it anymore. They're losing their retirement. A person who is in trouble with the casinos, if they have a rewards card and they tell the casino that they don't want this advertising anymore, they'll get it anyway. It's just like any other business. They keep sending them this stuff. I was deeply saddened when I saw people in wheelchairs and on walkers. I mean, and I was shocked the first time I saw somebody walking around with with an oxygen tank in a casino. You know,
not a good place with all that smoke either.
Smoke, people smoking cigarettes, and I thought, aren't we going to all blow up in here? But they will tell you that it's an outing. I talked to people when I was pretending. Now here I want to talk about part of how this book came about. I knew at some point when I started going back to the casinos. And it felt like I was being drawn against my will, because I'm leaving a pretty, you know, Madison's pretty to me. I'm leaving a pretty place where I had plenty of things to do, to go in a place I didn't like. And it was like, I don't understand this. So, and I was keeping a journal, notes, because it was such bizarre behavior. So then I decided, well, I'm going to write about it. So now I'm going to become, like an undercover journalist, like Barbara Ehrenreich, who's one of my favorite people.
Do you think that was like just a rationale for you to go to the casino?
Of course it was. Yeah. But it took me a long time, Norman, to understand this. I mean, I really...
You were duped.
I really, not only duped, something terrible was happening. Mm-hmm. And there was a point where I knew that I was in deep trouble. But, you know, after a couple of times, I started winning money. And then, you know, winning $1,100 the first time. And then two or three times later, I can't remember exactly what date it was when I went back and won $6,000. I was like, whoa. But I didn't like it. I felt dirty. You know, I felt that the money wasn't mine.
But you came back anyway.
I kept going back. And that's the part that wasn't making sense. So that's why I started writing in my journal. And there are times when I would write when I came home. Right.
And do you think you won money because you were good at it in
you
a way?
You can't be good at machines. It. You can't
so
be good
has anyone done the statistics on, you know, how many people actually lose money versus winning?
Oh, there are some mathematicians who've done that. I tried to read that, you know, because I was being a scholar, you mm-hmm. know, in quotation marks, you know. I got this book and it had all these mathematical formulas that I couldn't read, so I gave up on that. But the fact is, and this is what I try to tell people as I'm going out, in order for the state and the city, let's get back to economic development, to generate the new revenue that they all say they want by bringing casinos and slot machines into people's communities, the citizens have to lose millions of dollars.
Well, there's a simple answer to that question about how many people win or lose, because if you go into the casino, I've heard of people saying, okay, you see this, all this infrastructure here, you see all this building, you see all this fancy stuff, you know, who paid for it? People who lost at casinos.
It's the people who lost, yeah. And then the other point I want to mention about the people, these white men, billionaire white men who broker these deals, they get a percentage for over a period of years, the revenue that the casinos generate from people who are losing money. Now, since this is such a new industry, and by that I mean that prior to 1991, when a riverboat showed up in Iowa, of all places, the only place you could legally gamble, do casino gambling, was Las Vegas and Atlantic City. And then on the cruises to nowhere, to nowhere out in international waters off the coast of Florida. We now have a proliferation of casinos, a saturation, in fact. In fact, there's a Republican governor down in Iowa now, and he wants to run for governor, and it's going to be a difficult task because what he's arguing is no more casinos. And the people are up in arms and saying, but this generates new revenue and it gives us jobs. The construction jobs are not permanent. And the other point is that when people woke up a bit during this recession that we're in and stopped going so often, they started laying off people like any other industry. It's predatory. And I'm not hearing people talk about it as that. And the stakes for me feel very high because I got caught up. I should know better. But what about all these other people who are more desperate than I am, who are wasting, losing their welfare checks, trying to get that, jackpot, who don't have health care, who could be doing other things with their money, like paying their, light and gas bill? Where is the discussion about this? I'm not hearing it.
Is it a bipartisan issue or does it break down one party or the other espousing casinos and the other opposing, do you think?
It's a bipartisan issue because you've got Democrats also. But there are fewer people complaining than those who are saying, but this brings economic development. And right now it's the religious groups that are most opposed to, and that's the religious right that's most opposed to gambling. And their focus is on the family. In fact, focus on the family, that organization.
They don't have family night at casinos, do they? It's not exactly a family-friendly environment.
Well, yeah, but if you go to Ho-Chunk, you'll see Kids Quest. That's a child care center right there
do
in
they?
The casino.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're going to talk more about the book Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen when we return in a moment with University of the Air.
My father has a theory about gambling. This is my father. My theory is that this is a gambling establishment. They're in business to make money, not give it away. And when I go, I like to sit near the stage where I can see the girls singing while I'm playing the machines. What girl, Daddy? Whatever girl they got singing. Oh. There used to be a big white girl with red hair singing. She had a bluesy sound. If she was there singing, then I was just fine to sit there and put my few dollars into the machine. But I was not about to lose everything I came in with. No siree. $100. That was the most I'd allow myself. Well, Daddy, like I said, you're doing the same thing those other old people are doing. Next time you go, on your birthday, ask some of them. If they bother to talk to you, they'll tell you they also have a theory and a winning strategy. And be sure to let the customer service people know it's your 91st birthday so they can announce it and give you a gift, like a clock or some other piece of junk you don't need. That's what they gave Carla for her birthday, a cheap clock with the Motor City logo on it that was made in China and probably cost them about 50 cents or less. Of course, she had to go to the casino to pick it up. Can you imagine that? A place that doesn't even have clocks gives out cheap clocks for birthday presents. They send you a card and tell you to come and get your present. It suddenly occurred to me why my father wanted to go to Motor City Casino on his birthday. Daddy, did they send you a birthday card telling you to come and get your present? Is that why you want to go on your birthday? Do you have one of those rewards cards? Yeah, he said. I got that card around here somewhere. I'm supposed to bring it with me. He went into his bedroom and started rummaging around the stacks of papers on his dresser, pretending not to hear me. My father has a bad habit of claiming he can't hear when he wants to tune people out. I followed him into the bedroom and turned up the volume. Daddy, that's how they hook people. What's that you say, daughter? What's that you say? Daddy, you heard me. The casino industry ain't stupid. These cards and cheap gifts are nothing but marketing gimmicks. That's the way they lure you in so you can drop some money. They know they've got a big market in old people. Why else would the Greektown casino use an image of Rosa Parks to lure her people in? A few months earlier, I had read an article in the New York Times recounting how Rosa Parks' image was being used to market all kinds of things like the Chevy Silverado and Greektown casino. I thought to myself, Detroit has hit an all-time low. Nothing is sacred or revered, not even images of Rosa Parks, if they can help bring in the bucks. The ad showing a smiling Rosa Parks alongside the phrase, "What a ride," ran in the Detroit Free Press shortly after her death in 2005. I was in a food co-op with Miss Parks for almost a year in the late 1970s and sometimes saw her on Saturday mornings when she came to get her groceries. I chatted with her often enough on those days to know damn well that she wouldn't have wanted her picture used to promote gambling, or anything else for that matter.
That's an excerpt from Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen with our guest, Sandra Adell. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. And we're talking about this very personal memoir about a descent into gambling addiction. You write about Detroit, not only in this scene you just shared with us, but also just your childhood, your experiences as a teenage mother, and sort of looking back and finding that there is a link between that upbringing and what led you to the gambling route. Can you talk about that?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a link. I keep finding it. But part of writing this, of course, I started dealing with my childhood and the fact that I was a 14-year-old when I was pregnant. And this is the story that people have been telling me for so many years to write about, because it resonates, especially with groups like your Odyssey Project people and many other adults who've had troubled lives and then go back to school. So the literacy component is very important in this work. I'm very proud of the fact that I managed to get a GED and go on to the university. But people often ask me, how in the world that someone who was 14, living in Detroit, got pregnant, quit school in the ninth, completed the ninth grade, had no education beyond that, how do you manage to become a university professor? And so I describe that journey. I had my first child when I was 15. I had another child when I was 16, and at age 19, I had my third child. So I spent a lot of time in Detroit on welfare in poverty. And if anything, I'll tell you one of the things that kept me from going so completely off the deep end. I mean, this became more of an emotional bankrupt experience than financial bankrupting, because it was like, did I go through all of this, all of the difficult time, the work that I put in to try to ensure that my children were okay and that I would beat the odds that were stacked against me, because everyone said, you'll never get off welfare. You will always be a welfare mother, you know, with your children. If you don't give these children up for adoption, you're going to be a burden on society. I spent all of these years trying to prove this. That was a major thing. And of course, I had this great passion for literature. To wait until, when I should be relaxing finally, and get caught up in something that's about to destroy everything. The voice that was in my mind all the time when I'm wasting this money and being embarrassed about it was, you've come too far. This is shameful for you to waste money like this. You've come too far to risk everything that you've lived for. And there was the taint. And that's the hard part, even with putting this book out. The taint, okay, and even the term, Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen, somebody said, yeah, but it's ringing like the welfare queen. Well, you have to have a kind of a catchy title for you to get a book out. But the other part was that, yeah, it's another part of me that I felt was, let me put it this way. I spent so much time trying to overcome the fact that I was unwed, a welfare mother. My children were all considered illegitimate. So there's that stigma that I have carried all of my life. And then suddenly to get so involved in this gambling that I can't let go of, that's got a hold of me in a terrible way that I think I can write my way out of it, because I've always used books and reading to help me. It didn't work. I mean, I had to get some help, and we had to start pulling things apart and looking at this childhood. I don't know what the links are anymore. I leave that up to the professionals to figure that out. But I can say that I feel that by writing this, by coming through this with the help of a private therapist and good people over at Gateway Recovery Center, that I have come to some sense of peace about the trauma of the childhood experience, getting locked up. I was put in detention, a detention center twice. And these are things that when people look at me, they're not expecting this kind of a history.
I would think it would take a lot of courage to be as honest as you are.
I was desperate.
Yeah.
I was desperate. It was like, I'm writing like crazy. I'm taking these notes. I'm trying to figure out what was going on. I cannot go down this way. I've worked too hard. I cannot let machines take me down this way and take everything, rob me of everything, essentially, because the willpower was gone. But there's a point where I kept saying, this is not just about me. This is about what's going on in these spaces. So, you know, I got drunk one night at Ho-Chunk and passed out in the parking lot. And here's the thing that is so bothersome about that. I didn't know I had passed out. There's a watch in my house, a woman's watch on my desk. That's what I had. When I had come out of the casino, it was very late. And I was walking toward my car, and I saw something gleaming up from the ground, and I bent over to pick it up. And it was in my hand when I was helped off the ground with all these people, these men around on walkie-talkies and so forth. What's so curious to me is that they did not call 911. I was told later that I had been lying out there, that someone called into the casino and said, there's a woman lying on the ground here. And then I felt my forehead, and I had a bruise here. And then they said, well, we can't let you drive, so why don't you go into the hotel? And I said, I don't want to go back in there. So I got into my car, and they locked me in. I stayed there all night. And then when I got back to Madison, I immediately called Gateway. Because, I mean, I thought that was the bottom. Of course, that wasn't the bottom. There was another one. But this is very painful for me to even say now. It was at a point that I've got to do something because I'm losing everything. I'm losing control. This book is a lot about trying to not lose control.
More about the actual track that you took. I mean, let's start with the dollars and cents. You kept coming back because you were winning, or you were losing and you were still going back? I mean, how did all of that play out? You said it wasn't so much of a financial disaster as it was an emotional one.
Yeah, because at first when I started winning this money, I said, well, you know, as long as I, this is the irrational part, as long as I'm gambling with the money that I won, then there's not a problem here.
Right.
But once I start getting into my, you know, I'm not going to go into my earnings, which right. I started doing.
Okay, that's reasonable.
But the stress level started rising because I did start gambling with my earnings. And with the money I had saved.
There was a point there. Do you remember when you crossed that line?
When I started gambling on $25 slot machines.
$25 a pop.
Yeah. But there was something else happening. I mean, I was sick. I was getting sick. I mean, early on, I started feeling sick. I didn't understand that, you know, that this is a form of intoxication. I mean, I would leave out of a casino and feel very sick, nauseated.
And were you always alone? I mean, that first time you went with a friend.
The first few times I went with a friend. And then she likes to stay. And I wanted to leave. So I decided that she was the problem, not me. So I started going alone. And that was the other part of it. I was going getting up in the middle of the night. And I mean, these are things that I don't normally do.
Getting up in the middle of the night to go to the casino.
Yeah. Yeah. And these are things, I mean, I'm not going to get up in the middle of the night to go to the grocery store to get a loaf of bread, you know. So it was behavior that was changing. I couldn't sleep. I had nightmares because I could.
Kind of nightmares?
Just machines running after me, chasing me.
That does sound like the Twilight Zone.
Is swallowing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's the one that gave me the Twilight Zone story. but I think it's the childhood. It's the experience of coming through all of this poverty that was the work ethic that I had established that, you know, was gnawing at me. But this is soul-sucking activity, I'm going to tell you. It sucks the soul out of people. I felt my spirit, whatever my spirit and my soul is losing me. It's like playing with the devil because I always felt like I was going into hell. It's a labyrinth.
So is the allure partly the sort of adrenaline rush as the numbers are in the lights and everything?
I don't know.
Did you feel pleasure at the time you were?
Never.
Even when you were winning?
I put that money on my table. I would bring that money in, $100 bills, and leave it there and look at it. And I would tell myself, this is dirty money. You know, I am so sick. Why am I going? I don't want it. I would lose it all back and just leave. I don't want this money. Why am I here? But there was not pleasure. It was not pleasure. And one of the things that I've been trying to work out with, in a personal therapy situation is that I have had to live with a tremendously high threshold of stress. And maybe that's what it has something to do with. I can't explain this.
Was it linked at all to alcohol? You mentioned when you passed out that you'd been drinking.
Yeah, I was drinking more and more. All of this was causing me to drink more.
And they make alcohol readily available in those casinos. In some places, it's free, in fact.
Yeah, and happily, it's not free in Wisconsin. It's illegal to serve complimentary alcohol. But in Pennsylvania and most of the casinos.
In Vegas?
And in Pennsylvania and most of the casinos, they can serve free alcohol. And it's intended to keep you – everything in the casino is – everything about the casino is designed to keep you in your place in front of a machine or at a table and to scramble your good senses. Because there's a rational part of me. I mean, some of this stuff is rational. I'm writing this stuff. And this is – you know, this book has gone through several drafts because I had a lot of crazy – journal entries in it, you know, and then I would have these long arguments and discussions from these literary and you know, scientific works that I was trying to read because I was, and that was the hiding behind it, you know, as long as I could pretend that I'm, you know, writing, and I say pretend because I didn't know at the time I was pretending. I was seriously delving into studies about gambling addictions and so forth and the effects on the brain. And I felt that as long as I was doing that, then I'm not a gambling addict. And I don't call myself a gambling addict. I call myself, I have an addiction to these, you know, to gambling. And especially slot machines, because when I put that label on, it's just too freighted for me. But I'm also, you can't get me into a casino.
What are you addicted to?
Alcohol. And apparently I'm addicted to slot machines. So, I mean, once you go, Gateway, by the way, is an excellent treatment program because it's not a 12-step program. It's giving you the nuts and bolts of the progressions of addictions. So it's like, you know, a boot camp and it's very, you know, it's very clear to me. It was very clear to me what was happening and what was going to happen. So if you know that and it's made clear to you, and if I accept that, yeah, this was an addiction, then the next step is stay away from the casino, stay away from sounds that affect me, like my computer booting up, certain sounds on my phone.
Sure. There must be 100 sounds or more at a casino that you would subconsciously or consciously then associate with whatever it was that made you gamble.
I mean,
just in everyday life, there must be all kinds of similar sounds, or there's so much electronic noise in the air these days.
Yeah, the ones I can control in my house, I do. There are others that I can't control, of course. But it's like, oh, God, do I have to hear that ringtone on this?
But you would actually have this kind of Pavlovian response where you might be at home and there would be a sound that would make you want to go to the casino?
No, it triggers. It's a trigger now. And it's like, oh, get rid of the sound, period. I'm in the post, therapeutic field now. But I think that they were triggers before that would just prompt me to get in my car and drive to Ho-Chunk or to Pottawatomie or to Elgin, Illinois, wherever I was going.
It's like a post-hypnotic suggestion almost.
It is. It is. It's they talk about the neuroscientists talk about a reward center in the brain, and it's very Pavlovian. Is that right?
Yeah. So in this gateway environment, did you hear stories of other people? And if so, how did they compare with yours in terms of what brought them to gambling?
They weren't gambling. They were other addictions.
Oh, they were.
And that was one of the hard things for me because I was still finishing up my book at that time. And every time I said something about gambling in my book, it was like, no, talk about your addictions. And it was like, I'm trying to talk about it, but it's all about the book. There were people who had alcohol addictions, had several DUIs, and addictions to prescription medication. That was such an eye-opener because I went to an intensive outpatient therapy program. That started in mid-July 2010. No, 2009. I went to a counselor and then got into the next round of programs. So that would have been in August that I started this, three nights a week for about 6 weeks, from 5:30 to 8:30. And, I mean, they have a set program, a way of working you through all of these problems of addictions. But this was the first time being in a group session where people were addicted to drugs, alcohol, illegal drugs, alcohol, prescription drugs. We had people in the medical profession who were addicted to, you know, stuff that they had readily available. And it was a real eye-opener for me because it's like, I don't want to do this. Ooh, no, mm-hmm. no.
I doubt if anyone else did either.
Yeah. No, but we had people who had been into in rehab, in inpatient programs, you know, over one or two times, had been through this intensive outpatient more than once. And it was like a revolving door. And so this was a wake-up call to me. And it's like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to ever come back here.
I'm surprised you were able to be as high-functioning as you were while this was going on. Because if you're getting up in the middle of the night, you're spending a lot of time having your soul sucked out of you, but then you have to teach university classes and carry on as if all is well.
Well, some of this started in the summer. And then there were periods. Here was the other thing that was tricky, because there were periods. I called it a gambling binge that was going to end soon. But there were periods where I was doing other things. I'm very high functioning. I have to be. I had to be in order to raise three children at such a young age. But I was also in plays. And if I was in a play, and I talk about being, I have a chapter in this book called The Queen of Hearts. Well, I was the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland. And so things slowed down a little bit then. And then it would speed up again. But I'm used to functioning at a very, very high level of stress. And then teaching, doing those things slowed me down a little bit. So it was not like I was going every day. I was taking care of all of my business. So outwardly, nobody knew what was happening to me, because I wasn't actually, and I certainly wasn't sending them copies, of my manuscript saying, look, I'm going crazy. Could you read this? I mean, so I kept it very personal. And even now, when the book came out, my colleagues and others are like, this just happened? We thought this was like your past. And it was like, no. I have to say that people in my department have been very, very supportive. I was frightened because, I was arrested for drunk driving. And the penalties, the financial penalties are high. There are a lot of fees and everything. But it was just the pain.
Not to mention the danger.
The danger. I mean, I'm so glad that man got me off the road. Something happened that night. And this has been a long time. I thought I was working through all of these problems. But I thought it was connected to this book, because I was sending it out and people were saying, agents to New York, big time literary agents. And they were saying how well written it was and, oh, great and compelling, but it's not dramatic enough. And I just got up one night and said, you want some drama? Why don't I go up here and finish it off? Yeah, something happened, something. I had been drinking. Something happened there. And there was this period of insanity. And then when I realized how much trouble I was in, that, again, was very difficult. The world did not collapse. And I have to tell you also that some of the people who are the most supportive are some of the African-American undergraduate organizations. They're asking me to give talks. I'm going to give a talk tonight at one of their events. And that is very sobering, because I have to be accountable now. It's out. And it's very sobering for me in many ways. And I appreciate the fact that I'm being embraced in the way that I am by these young people. Because this, we have a problem with drinking here. You got a professor who got arrested in handcuffs. And I mean, I put on a performance. I never saw the police report. I probably shouldn't say that.
Well, was there a point at which you said, I've kicked this, I've kicked the gambling, I've kicked the drinking?
No. What I'm saying is simply is that I have some choices today, and I choose not to drink any alcohol, and I choose certainly do not go gambling.
So what would you say to somebody who says, well, I'm going to go to Ho-Chunk and I'm going to allot $50. Now, I might spend that much going to dinner and a movie, and I'll just say, okay, when it's gone, I go. If I make more than that, I'll keep going until I'm, tired or just down back to even. What do you say to somebody who has that kind of rational, just recreational approach to it?
I think it's fine. I think it's fine. My issue and my concern is the expansion of casino gambling across the country. We have enough casinos, and the argument that's being made by the people who are pro-casino expansion is that you only have, 3.2% of the population who gambles, who are addicted and have, committing suicide and being bankrupt and, embezzling and going to prison and all that. They're getting those numbers from reported cases. We don't know. And this is a new industry. We don't know how many people are really suffering from this. It would be foolish to say, let's abolish gambling. It's here to stay. But what I'm saying is that when elected officials begin to talk to their citizens about the importance of bringing a casino into a community, as they're doing down in Beloit now, because Janesville has closed, and that would bring jobs and economic development because tourists are going to come to Beloit, ask some questions and have somebody and demand an independent study, somebody that the casino industry isn't paying. The latest in Chicago residents have defeated for about 15 years efforts to put a casino near Navy Pier. The latest is that they want, and it's going to be on the November referendum, to bring in slot machines or video terminals, electronic gambling devices, into the restaurants and bars and taverns. Now, they're not going to put them on Michigan Avenue, downtown. They're going to put them into communities of color, into the poor communities. And so I think that there needs to be some discussion about what's happening in this country with the proliferation, the continued expansion of casinos.
Is there anyone saying that casinos should somehow be responsible the way, you know, bartenders are now sometimes held responsible for people who are out of control?
Yeah. They do a lot, certain funding to training their staff to be aware of people who seem to be out of control. But most of the time, that doesn't work.
And I mean, how could you actually stop it? You can't just say, well, you've lost too much money. It's time to go home.
Well, they try.
They can. But
nobody's going to go home. You know, it's up to the individual to decide that they need some help. And the way they do it in the casinos is they have something called an exclusion list, where you can get your picture taken and then you sign this form that says that you won't come on this property. And now once you do that, and if you go to one of the Ho-Chunk casinos, for example, and they recognize you, they can have you arrested for trespassing.
No, the exclusion list is because you've overspent?
No, because
it's a voluntary thing?
It's a voluntary overspent. Usually it's somebody who's in desperate trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Not like somebody who's just overspent, you know, the person with the $50 and says, okay, I'm going to lose $100. But they're not going to come back. Or if they come back, they're going to come with their same little $50 or so. But I'm talking about people who are in serious trouble, who can place themselves on an exclusion list. And that enables the security at the casino to make them leave or to have them arrested for trespassing. They don't do it. First of all, there's so many people going into casinos that it's hard to spot some of these folks. Now, if they have a win, though, they don't get the money.
If they have a win, they don't get the money?
Now,
they're on the exclusion list.
If they're on the exclusion list and they go in and win some money, and it has to be a certain amount of money. It has to be at least over $1,200 because you have to fill out a form for that. Then they won't get the money. The casino withholds it. But people do all kinds of stuff. They put on disguises and go, or they go to another casino. I mean,
well, yeah, that's true. If there's another casino, that's an option.
Yeah.
And so having done the book and now having spoken about it, which must be sort of both a relief in a way to have it out in the open, but also painful to keep going over the same material. But what lessons do you think there are for other people? Even if they're not interested in gambling, does it extend to other areas where you experience?
Other areas of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very inspiring book in terms of my own experience with the literacy program, with the GED program, that people can create some goals for themselves and meet them. If they get into a program like yours, because that's similar to the program that I was in, and
the
that's
Odyssey
the Odyssey program. Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit? You say books help to save you.
I read all the time. Books saved my life. I read all the time. Even when I was in Detroit as a young, unwed mother, I had no money. So I went to the library. I read books, and those books transported me to other places. They've always done that for me. They continue to do that for me. I mean, other worlds open up. You know, the imagination gets activated. You know this because mm-hmm. you teach literature. Both of you are great readers, a chapter a day. And that's the safety net. Someone asked me that yesterday when I was at this Wisconsin Literacy Awards ceremony. What motivated you to get out of the situation that you were in as an unwed teen mother? And I said it was the safety net were books and reading. I was always very highly literate. And when I look at this experience, this book is saving me, my life.
And I would think a slot machine is almost like the anti-book.
The anti-book.
There's absolutely nothing literary about a slot machine.
Nothing at all. Nothing at all. But the epilogue of this book talks about me going to Russia in 2002, and standing in the apartment where Dostoevsky wrote one of his last books, and just feeling and crying, even though I couldn't understand what they were saying and the docent was saying because it was all in Russia. But, you know, as I said, I like to think that, because we can imagine, that Dostoevsky was speaking to me that day and said, remember the gambler. Let this be a cautionary tale. Thank you.
Thank you for your cautionary tale, Sandra Adel. Always a pleasure to have you with us. It's been quite the engaging personal narrative.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as we look at literary history from a particular standpoint, that of the sonnet. We'll be looking at three different sonnets next Sunday as part of a way of surveying English literature. It works quite well, as it turns out. That's next Sunday afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio.